Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and on today's First Coast Connect, with some 30 schools potentially on the chopping block, parents across Duval County are uniting to battle the proposed consolidation. We'll be talking later to three members of three different organizations on why the community schools fighting to save community schools should be everyone's fight. But first, while there are few unifying factors in the current political climate, concern over the strength of our democracy is one expressed by all sides. Finding ways to make our democracy more resilient and responsive is the focus of tonight's event at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center in downtown Jacksonville. And to give us a preview, I'm joined now by two featured speakers, Will Brown, race, poverty, and inequality reporter at Jacksonville Today. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Ann.
And Desmond Mead, president and executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Welcome, Desmond.
Good morning, Ann.
It's great to have you, Desmond. You were named one of Time's most 100 influential people of the year in 2019, but still not everyone knows your story. Remind us a little bit about your background and how you came to voter activism.
Yes, thank you so much for having me this morning. I consider myself an ordinary guy who at one point in life was addicted to drugs, and I found myself in and out of jail and prisons and eventually homeless on the streets, and you know, through a series of traumatic events and to a point that led me to a point where I wanted to commit suicide, I was able to rebound from that and get substance abuse treatment and enroll myself in one of the local colleges and universities and just committed myself to giving back to the community. And the main area was around restoring voting rights to people with previous felony convictions. And that's been my story. And we were successful in 2018 when I led the effort to restore voting rights to approximately 1.4 million Floridians with previous felony conviction.
We've spoken in the past, Desmond, and I know that that dark period in your life, it was almost kind of a metaphorical crossing over. I mean, you say you brought yourself to the point of, you know, considering suicide, literally kind of at a railroad tracks, but you crossed the tracks. You went on to get your law degree, which was a remarkable accomplishment for somebody who'd had as many challenges. The limits on being a former felon affected you in your desire to become a lawyer and also your desire to vote for your own wife when she decided to seek public office.
Oh man, you remember that moment, Ann. Yeah, that was a very decisive moment in my life because even, you know, I was advocating for voting rights prior to my wife running for office, but it did not hit home until she ran for office and I realized that, wow, I couldn't even vote for her. And so what that did was just put gasoline on a fire that was already burning. And it just really caused me to amp it up, especially coupling that with another story of an elderly man who, you know, was denied the right to vote because 8 years prior, he had got convicted for driving with a suspended license. And me thinking about how this man is going to die before getting an opportunity again to be a part of this democratic process. Stories like that and me not being able to vote for my wife, that was more than enough fuel for my fire to ensure that we were successful with our Amendment 4 efforts in 2018.
And you were successful. A statewide vote like that requires a 60% threshold for approval. You exceeded that, you got almost 65%. And so that was the largest rights restoration in this state's history, and it brought to an end 150 years of laws that were established under Jim Crow with the specific goal of discriminating against Black voters in Florida.
Well, listen, first of all, we blew it out the water, right? And let me be honest, you know, it was the largest expansion, right, of voting rights in the entire country, right, in the last 50 years, you know, prior to that happening. And so this was huge, and it went beyond Florida. And I think what was so telling about it was that it also inspired other states or folks in other states to expand voting rights, whether it was in Wisconsin and New Mexico last year. We've seen it in North Carolina, in California, in Louisiana. And so it was a watershed moment in 2018. But the most beautiful thing about that moment was that we was able to accomplish that, not by stoking people's fears or their anger, but rather by just capturing, you know, that feeling of love, forgiveness, and redemption, and let that be our driving force.
There is an exception to this rights restoration. It automated rights restoration, this amendment. There was an exception for people who were convicted of sex offenses or murder. But everybody else, and most of the people prior to Amendment 4, you know, were denied their voting rights restoration because of nonviolent drug offenses, we should say. But this is an important matter. It's not just voting. It's also who makes up the roles of federal court juries. So federal courts, when they're selecting juries, they use voter rolls to pick that pool. And that also matters in terms of the criminal justice system.
Well, in Florida, and even in the state courts, you cannot, once you are convicted of a felony offense, and that's any felony offense, so it could be as simple as driving with a suspended license, or catching a lobster whose tail is too short, or even trespassing on a construction site, or my favorite, releasing helium-filled balloons in the air. That's enough to get you a felony conviction in Florida. And if you are convicted, you cannot serve on a jury until your civil rights have been restored. And so at its height, Florida had over 1.68 million people, right? People who served our country in the military, you know, teachers, lawyers, doctors, you know, all kinds of folks from all walks of life who, because they made one mistake, could no longer even serve on a jury, run for office, or even vote. And so it was much widespread, and it was even more pronounced, right, in our state criminal system or our state legal system.
This was automated, as we say, the voting rights restoration through this amendment as it passed. Prior to, there was a mechanism to get your rights back, your voting rights back. It had to go basically to a clemency board. The governor had to sign off on it. But it really was stymied for a number of years. Under Governor Charlie Crist at the time, he'd restored 155,000 people's voting rights. But under Governor Rick Scott, that dwindled to just 3,000. And most of those, three times as many, were, you know, white former offenders than black former offenders.
Yeah, and let's be clear. That was 8 years of Governor Rick Scott's administration. Charlie Crist, in his 4 years, you've seen 155,000 people. Prior to that, even Governor Jeb Bush, in his 4 years, had over 75,000 people have their civil rights restored. But under the 8 years of Governor Rick Scott, you've seen only 3,000 people have their rights restored. And then with our current governor, God knows that number is even far less than that. And so we've seen the process of having the clemency board restore individuals' rights was purely arbitrary. And there was no rhyme or reason in how they were restoring people or granting requests to have your civil rights restored. As a matter of fact, if you can remember, it took me a while. You know, here I am. My organization last year was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. You mentioned that I was to one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential in the world. I was Floridian of the Year, Central Floridian of the Year, right? Obtained a law degree, and I still had to struggle to get my civil rights restored, right? And so if there's no rhyme and reason, that leaves so much room for partisan politics to play a heavy role in determining which American citizen get to vote and which American citizen don't get to vote. And that was something that was very scary to us, and one of the reasons that prompted us to launch this citizens initiative, because something as valuable and sacred as being able to vote should not be controlled by any politician, whether they're Democrat, Republican, Independent, or any other kind of political party. No politician should have that much control in determining which American citizen get to vote and which American citizen do not get to vote.
We can get in a minute to what subsequently happened after that amendment was approved by voters and sort of the stumbling blocks that it's been hitting in courts and in the political world. But I want to remind listeners, we're talking with voter activist Desmond Mead. ahead of his appearance tonight at the TEDx Jacksonville Democracy Salon. He's also going to be joined by Will Brown, reporter with Jacksonville Today. You can join our conversation live on the air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. I want to bring in Will Brown to this conversation. Will, along with Desmond, you are one of four speakers at tonight's TEDx event. And you're coming at this from a little bit of a different perspective, not as an activist, but as a journalist.
Correct. And, you know, I did want to say Desmond says he's an extraordinary person, but I would disagree. I'd say he's a very extraordinary because he's a living testimony. So I did want to say that. But what I am coming from is as someone who's a native Floridian and a journalist, and I'm discussing how people can learn lessons about democracy through the lessons that we all learned playing youth sports.
And we should say you have a long background in reporting. You worked for the Jacksonville Business Journal. You've covered logistics. You've covered business. But you also have your roots as a young reporter at the Tallahassee Democrat doing sports.
Yes.
That's been a big passion of yours, continues to be.
Continues to be. I've always loved sports. I learned to multiply by watching football. So I learned counting and division, multiplication and division through baseball statistics. So I've always been passionate about sports. And sports is a way that connects us. You know, there are tens of thousands of kids who play Little League Baseball in this state. You know who also played Little League Baseball? Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis was a fabulous baseball player. He played in the Little League World Series. So the lessons that people learn about sportsmanship are lessons that we all learn. And I called DeSantis out. It's not calling him out, but he was a fabulous baseball player. And so the Little League motto that I mentioned, that I recited when I was a 12-year-old Little League player, was the same motto that DeSantis mentioned, the same motto that today's Little Leaguers mentioned.
What is that motto?
You know, it's been a couple
decades. Sorry,
okay,
don't mean to call you out on that. But why is it that you found sports a useful lens to talk about strengthening democracy?
Because in sports, people acknowledge that they lost. You know, earlier this hour, we were mentioning Coco Gauff, but, you know, she played in the French Open yesterday and she won 6-3, 6-4. But if she would have lost, she wouldn't have said the game was rigged. She wouldn't have said, oh, well, my opponent cheated. She would have said, I didn't have it today. My opponent was better. And that is something that politicians of all parties can learn to emulate. And so that was one thing I really focused on, is accepting that someone might be better than you on a given day, because that is something children are taught from the time they're 6, 7, 8 years old.
So you have framed your TED Talk presentation with kind of four primary sports metaphors, if you will, or analogies. Run us through those four.
The first one is losing stinks. Accept it. It happens. Another one was, one of those was, well, let me go back. Here we go. Sportsmanship is not weakness. Okay. You know, it's okay to help your opponent up. It's okay to be highly competitive while, you know, acknowledging your opponent's presence.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost a lot of that in electoral politics. You know, it's but that's something that children are taught at a young age.
And just to pause on that for a minute, I mean, what does sportsmanship mean to you? What should it mean to us?
You know, I think of, I was not old enough to vote, but I think about in 1994 when Lawton Childs beat Jeb Bush to win the gubernatorial election, and they just happened to be in the same spot about 48 hours later, and Bush went up to Childs and congratulated him and said, I wish you success. Essentially, your success is our success. That wouldn't happen today. And so, to me, sportsmanship is competing to be the best you can be, and if someone's better than you, shake their hand and keep it moving.
Mm-hmm. So you have losing stinks, accept it. Sportsmanship is not weakness. What is another one of the four that you're discussing tonight?
Past history does not guarantee future success. Mm. And I went down some rabbit holes because Desmond was earlier speaking about voting rights and how it was put into the Florida Constitution. And so that was it was literally put into the 1885 Florida Constitution. I just looked it up. It was Section 6, Article 4. Of the Florida 1885 Florida Constitution that said people who were convicted of a felony cannot vote. And it was very vague about who would have constituted a felony. Everything in that past history doesn't guarantee future success. It's, you know, I mentioned Florida State University and how that university was not really well known until it got a football program. And then all of a sudden it's well known all across the country.
It's a dynasty.
It's a dynasty. And so, but also in the terms of Florida State, where, hey, they probably should have had a chance to play for a national championship last year, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just have to accept that. And that's not something that we often see in our nationalized politics or our big, you know, Senate races and presidential races. We still sometimes see it. We still see it at the local level, or I've seen it at the local level, and I'm sure you have as well, where people acknowledge their opponent, but we don't see that as much at the bigger levels.
I want to get to your fourth in just a second, but I want to take a call or two here. We've got Mark on the west side. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning. I hate to rain on your guys' parade, but, you know, we hear this all the time, and it's taken as given that you know, sports is good for our youth, and it teaches them, you know, leadership and how to get along. And, you know, we kind of accept that, and I don't think that's true at all. I think maybe the opposite is true. I remember a million years ago when I was going for a criminal justice major, I asked this very question. I got an N at the intake on a Saturday night at the sheriff's office, and I asked that specific question of everybody that was coming through that door: did you have any involvement in sports? Yeah, you know, high school, whatever. And my professor at the time was wondering about my methodology, because it was 100% of these people that were in there for spouse abuse and DUI and everything in between hadn't been involved in sports. And I said, see, this is not, and you know, all the corruption that's associated with big money sports. I mean, to this day, when I was 10 years old, and I played youth sports all my life. But when I was 10 years old, I had an adult man bring me in front of my team of my peers and say I was the worst player on the team. And he did this. It wasn't just me. He would do this on a weekly basis. I mean, that sticks with me.
Yeah, Mark, it's a good point. And obviously, there's somewhat of a difference between youth sports and professional sports.
Massive but difference.
You, I guess, are focusing more on the idealized version of what sports should be.
Yes, yes. Really focusing on youth and community sports for that reason. Because, and I mentioned, the caller mentioned, like, that big sports has become something totally different. And I'm not disagreeing with him at all. I'm talking about the lessons that are learned in youth sports. One thing I mentioned in my speech is, I think it was 7 or 8 years old. And after a game, we lost. And I said, bad game to my opponents. Walter and Sheila Brown were not having that.
Is that mom and dad?
They shut it all down. And they said, you will never do that again. They might beat you, but you will never say bad game again. I can't remember a lot of things I did playing soccer, but I can remember when they got me right together about how I would lose with grace.
Yeah, well, it sort of speaks to the fact that kind of reaction really is childish at its base, right? It really does require some intellectual and emotional maturity to accept a defeat with grace.
Yes. And it's the lessons that my parents taught me are the lessons I'm now teaching my third grader, last week of third grade. His you know, he goes to fencing lessons and is about to have a fencing tournament. And it's like, buddy, you're not going to win all the time, but you have to keep trying. You have to keep pushing yourself. And that's what I'm really talking about how if you push yourself, if you try, if you take those lessons, that's what from youth sports and community sports, it will serve you well, and the politicians at the national level would be well served to remember those lessons as well.
I want to take a call from our buddy Stanley on the north side. Good morning, Stanley. Go ahead.
Good morning. Great job here. Now, Will, I'm going to have to push back, too, because I disagree. Whenever it comes to seeing this, when it comes to African-American, that's the only thing we can do, and I have a problem with that because that's not true. Why you're not talking about STEAM? Or STEM technology, the things of the future for the youth, because they can compete in that category and develop sportsmanship through that too. But I see this, it's the same thing as the caller just said, the same thing, especially when it comes to the African-American community. Thank you.
Thanks, Stanley. I also want to take a call from Ted in Green Cove Springs. Good morning, Ted. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm going to agree with your guest and disagree with the caller who were criticizing team sports. My son has played soccer and football all the way through Leano High School about 10 years ago, and some of his best friends were African-Americans, teammates. They don't look at each other from race or from religion or from ethnicity. They were teammates, and they back each other.
Ted, I think we might have lost you. I want to steer back to Desmond just for a minute, because we talked about the success of Amendment 4, Desmond, and yet almost immediately there was some political pushback on that. And the governor signed a law the next year that required additional actions be taken before somebody could have their rights restored. And that primarily was satisfying any fines or fees or debts that they had prior to being eligible for that rights restoration.
Yes, it did. But here's the thing, though, right? I think the pushback really came from politicians. And I want to be very clear with that. It was totally different than who we've seen come out to actually support Amendment 4. Over 5.1 million people voted yes, right? And that was over a million more people voted for our initiative than for our governor, right? And on top of that, we had over a million people who voted for our initiative that were registered Republicans, right? And so I like to tout that, because it really showed that, no, we can bring people together, right? That even though, like that first caller, when he said, well, I hate to rain on your parade, and in my head, I was like, bro, you're not raining on anybody's parade. If anything, you bring a little sunshine, right, to our conversation, because you bring in light to our conversation. You bring in a different perspective to our conversation. And there may be some things that we may not have experienced or even considered, but because of your input, we now have a more vibrant conversation and a more a vibrant approach to solving our issues. And that's what we've seen with Amendment 4. That listen, we had people that were conservative, progressive, young, old, Latinx, or white or black, different religions that came together. We had over 870 congregations of faith, whether they were conservative Christians, whether they were African-American clergy, whether they were conservative Latino evangelicals, whether they were Muslims, or whether they were Jewish, people of Jewish faith. They all came together, right, with saying, let my people vote. They all came together saying yes to second chances. Now, there's so many things that we may differ on, but, man, there are some key core values that we do agree on, and those are the values that drove us. But when we crossed the finish line successfully, then the politics came into play, and that is the problem, right? It is how politics have progressed that caused people who would agree on so many things to all of a sudden now think that we have to fight each other over every issue, over every nuance of our conversation. And that is not who we are as a people, because no one wants to wake up next to a neighbor that he's scared of or hates, right? That deep down inside, we do want to be able to live in community in spite of our differences, right? Whether you went to Florida State or you went to University of Florida, or whether you went to Alabama or Auburn, you know, in spite of our differences, there's so much more that can bring us together. And if we can somehow or another figure out how to remove politics, right, from our discourse and engage in conversations around the things that identify us and connect us along the lines of humanity, there's so much more that we can accomplish in this great state of Florida, so much more that we can accomplish in our country or even in the world.
In terms of having, you know, diverse support for this this amendment, this when it passed, I mean, you had support from the Koch brothers, which are, you know, very kind of considered pretty far to the right in terms of the financing, the issues that they typically tackle. You also had support from the ACLU, so it was a pretty broad spectrum. And yet this new requirement that fees and fines be satisfied has been difficult. And we should say it's because there really is no central repository for that information. So if somebody's released from prison, they don't have a tally somewhere on a court docket or in their personal file that they can just say, well, I owe this much to this person or that court and satisfy it. So you shifted.
Well, listen, let me be.
Go ahead.
Yeah, let me be very clear with this, right? There is no legitimate reason for erecting obstacles that prevent people from participating in our democracy, right? The more people we have participating in our democracy, the more vibrant our democracy becomes. And our motivation for expanding democracy is not based on how people may vote or how people may think, whether or not people like us or not. We fought just as hard for that person that wanted to vote for Donald Trump as we did for that person who wished they could have voted for Barack Obama. We want to make sure that every citizen have an opportunity to be engaged in this process. And I think it's very important to understand that, that folks need to know that this was more universal. And actually, to be totally honest with you, I really do believe that our democracy and the right to vote is less political than people are making it today.
You have shifted gears, though, somewhat, your organization, because of this challenge, to finding funds for people to satisfy and to helping them pay off those debts. And you've had some really prominent folks make donations to that effort.
Yeah, we had a couple of stars, like LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Ariana Grande, people like Rihanna, Hailey Bieber's. I remember when we started the fundraising campaign, we had over 90,000 Americans, 90,000 people that donated to our fines and fees fund to help folks pay off their fines and fees. But we also, in addition to that, we challenged the state of Florida. We're like, wait a minute. Now, if you're telling us that we have to pay fines and fees prior to being able to vote, then you got to be in a position to be able to tell us what fines and fees we owe, so we can take care of this responsibility that you're placing on us. And if you can't tell us that, then we got some problems that we need to talk about, And so we were attacking it from various angles, either through trying to work with the state to create a better system, through raising money to help people who are too poor to pay their fines and fees. And of course, no American citizen should be forced to choose between paying their mortgage or rent or putting food on their table or being able to vote. Voting should be freely accessible to every qualified American citizen in this country. And we're going to continue fighting for that. And then, of course, we have the courts that we can use as well to encourage our judicial system to either waive those fines and fees or convert those fines and fees to community service hours and allow a person the ability to be able to participate in our democracy.
Will Brown, we didn't get to all four of yours, but you are going to be there tonight. So this event not only has the speeches that you'll be giving, also there's a presentation by two other speakers. Hope McMath is one of them.
Ramon Perez is the other.
Thank you. And then you'll be answering questions and having some breakouts with people there. So this is an event to talk about democracy, but there's going to be some breakout discussions. I talked to the organizers today. There's only 10 tickets left. So if people are interested, they do have to buy them online by 3:00 today. But I know you're looking forward to this.
I am super looking forward to it. The fourth lesson is information is more important than news. And I specifically say that democracy survives with people actively choosing information and applying it. And that'd be akin to leaving your house on a Friday night, going to a high school football game, and paying for a reserve ticket at midfield. You have to apply the information once you get it.
Well, we are looking forward to your presentation tonight, Will. Desmond Mead as well. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about your efforts to preserve democracy and advice for all of us that we can take and learn from. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Stick around. Up next, the possibility of public school consolidation looms and parents are taking a stand. Do 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 Welcome back. A plan to eliminate as many as 30 public schools has energized parents and advocates across Duval County, now united with a common goal of saving their neighborhood institutions. To talk about it now, I am joined by Katie Hathaway, Duval County school parent and member of Public School Defenders. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Tiffany Clark, former Duval school parent and member of Parents Who Lead.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good to have you, Tiffany. And Kimberly Wolfson, Atlantic Beach resident and advocate with Save Atlantic Beach Elementary. Good morning,
yes.
Kimberly.
Good morning, Anne. Thank you for having us.
And we invite your calls or comments. You can reach us at 904-549-2937. And you can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. Tiffany, how did you first learn about this plan that would involve school closures, and how did you receive it?
I first learned about the plan through the news. I was on Facebook, and something came across my feed back in April, I believe, March-April timeframe. And that's how I first learned about the new plan that we are now discussing now.
And what was your reaction?
Oh, gosh, it was like a jolt in my chest. The first thing I thought about, wow, that half cent sales tax. what does that mean for us now? And really that bold new plan, the first thing that came to mind is, okay, so now we have another plan. Mm-hmm. I thought about our families, and I thought about what this is now saying to us as a community as a whole, because it seems like, you know, we're going to reset.
Remind us about that tax, what that was intended to provide and what that bold plan that you referenced was
so
supposed to do.
So the master facilities plan, if the listeners remember, that half cent sales tax that we voted on was for, because Florida, as you know, has some of the oldest schools in the district. And so we voted on a new plan for construction, to remodel and renovate.
You mean Jacksonville
some of the oldest schools. Jacksonville, yeah. Yes, has some of the oldest schools in the district. And so that new plan was to help us remodel and renovate those schools and bring them to a place where, you know, that's conducive to learning for our children.
So at the time, the idea was that we were going to have this half cent sales tax that's going to help sustain our schools into the next, you know,
That is correct. That is correct.
And so this is somewhat of a scaling back of that. In fact, rather diametrically opposed, Katie. Now we're looking at, rather than building new schools or, you know, reinforcing their infrastructure, to just outright closing.
Yeah. So what also happened, our school board approved this plan in 2019 and asked for a special election. The city council denied that and delayed that by a whole year. So then the voters voted in 2020 and overwhelmingly supported this. And so we started receiving those funds in 2021. So we're now like 2 years fully out from when the board originally approved this bold plan. And things look a lot differently now. We went through a pandemic. There's inflation and construction costs, and a lot of charters have popped up. And the state legislature also passed a new law in between that time that requires school districts to share this revenue with charter schools based on enrollment rather than need. So, and I will say the bold plan did account for declining enrollment and just different things that could potentially happen in between then over the 15 years.
And we should say that requirement that, you know, revenues, capital money be split with charter schools was what led to the city council and the then mayor, Lenny Curry, agreeing to support the half cent sales tax.
Yes. Yes. There was heavy discussions about charters getting their cut of that funding from our city council.
So one of the things, Kimberly, that you have been looking at, you represent for Atlantic Beach Elementary. Mm-hmm. That has been getting a lot of attention. There has been a lot of, you know, activism on that front. People are very concerned about the closing potentially of that community school. And yet it's just one of many mm-hmm. that's on the list. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you're trying to do with the Atlantic Beach, you know, effort? Mm-hmm. As it relates to these other schools on the list?
Sure. That's a great question. We were a little bit late, I think, to the table to understanding this issue because it hadn't yet been on our doorstep. Where I know, like Tiffany living in District 4, they had already experienced school consolidation and closure going back the past few years. So when we were alerted to this, seeing the new revised MFP that came out, and realized Atlantic Beach Elementary, as well as multiple other beaches schools being on this list, that just woke us up to the need to fight as hard as we could for our neighborhood school. And in doing so and in learning about this issue, we're very much aware that we're one piece of this bigger puzzle, and it's going to take all of us together across the seven districts that make up DCPS, working in unison, knowledge sharing, advocating on each other's behalfs, learning about each other to save our schools.
And to the extent that Atlantic Beach is in a district that is, you know, perhaps somewhat more privileged financially than some of these other school districts, is there a sense of obligation that Atlantic Beach and that effort represent more broadly?
I think very much so. I mean, one of the things that we're doing that I feel very fortunate that we're able to do is meet with people across the district, across all of, when I say the district, I mean like Duval County, and learn what their unique needs are, because each of these schools, Tiffany and I were just, and Katie were talking about this before we came on, they might have unique sets of challenges, but ultimately the best solution for these children is that they keep their neighborhood school. And there's a variety of reasons that look slightly different depending on the neighborhood you're in as to why that matters. But we from Save ABE really believe wholeheartedly and are using our voice and our platform to speak on behalf of these other schools. And I think we will be successful to get, or failed together. And I mean, obviously, our goal is that we succeed in saving these. So we're doing things like sharing our resources, sharing our research, representing when we can, showing up at meetings across the district, networking. I think just even the relationships that we're forming are going to serve us well as we move forward. We don't really know what the future is going to look like as we work to keep these schools open. But I think the fact that we have open communication and we now know each other and can pick up the phone and call, that's going to really go a long way.
And Tiffany, what do we know about the importance of public schools, community schools, and what happens when they are closed?
That's a great question. So as we were discussing earlier, many of our community schools, many of our families, they're tied, these schools are tied to their legacy. They're tied to, you know, what makes them family. They're tied to the family dollar, the Dollar General, the grocery stores. And it goes much deeper than giving a school an A or F or C or D or an F and saying, okay, well, I'm not just going to choose that school. These schools are tied literally to the very core of what it means to be family, specifically in districts 4 and 5, where, you know, we've seen school closures already and consolidations.
For people who aren't familiar with the district borders, give us an idea where you're talking about.
So just for example, I have the privilege of being a part of Chairman Daryl Willey's district, District 4. And there, you know, we have, when we talk about the borders, we're talking about on the north side. So some of our north side schools, to make it, to simplify that, a lot of our north side schools, for example, in the last 2 years, we've had, for example, Brentwood Elementary closed. Mm-hmm. And so that, again, these schools are tied to the legacy, and it means a great deal when these children cannot just walk to their neighborhood school.
And Katie, when a school closes, has there been much research into, you know, fallout impacts, what is left behind, in addition to just this, the physical structure of a school?
Well, I just want to state, to piggyback off what you just said, you just can't underestimate the value of providing transportation to these community schools for children, to providing meals that our school, our public schools do for children, athletics, enrichment activities, extended day. These are services that our traditional public schools do provide to communities that charter schools do not have to provide.
And so the absence of those means just kind of losing those core functions that
I mean, this is supporting our community as a whole, our public schools, and our, we believe that public schools are a public good, and they're what makes our community thrive. They're the heartbeat of our communities here across Duval County. Our traditional public schools are.
And so some of the schools that are on this list, I mean, there's some high schools, but there are a number of elementary schools, including John Stockton Elementary, which was last year ranked the country's second best elementary school. Kimberly, if that's not sufficient to keep a school off of this list, I mean, obviously they're looking at much more of a financial lens. And it's kind of unavoidable. We are talking about billions of dollars needed.
And I think Anne, you're touching on a really critical point. The plan that the school board and the superintendent's office asked the consultant to put together only factored in cost efficiencies and utilization rates. So the other number that they looked at was if a school has X number of seats, how many of those seats are actually filled? And for a variety of reasons, that number is a little bit misleading, or a lot of bit misleading, but they didn't look at anything like quality of education, support from the community, support from parents, well-being of the child, what learning environment does a child learn best in. None of those were factors that went into making this decision, which is why you see very high-performing, well-attended, very successful public schools that are pillars of our community on this list.
And just briefly, when you say they're misleading, what is misleading about the numbers when they say that their seat's empty or vacant?
Sure. So they look at the number of classrooms, and some of those are intentionally left open for resources, like Katie was saying, music and art and other enrichment programs take place in these classrooms that they need to stay open and available and not fill with a classroom, or else the children wouldn't have that space. And then the other number that they don't factor are VPK into utilization rates. So children who participate in the VPK programs aren't factored into the calculation of the number of children utilizing a school.
Those VPK classes sometimes held in the public school, you mean?
They are held in the public schools.
Mm-hmm. And so do you feel like that the school board gave the correct task to the consultant? I mean, if they're just looking at the financials and the vacancy rates as opposed to a broader mix of considerations?
I mean, I think my opinion on that is that when we're trying to provide a public education to our children, and our goal is to provide the best quality of education that we can, how you don't look at education doesn't make much sense to me. I mean, I understand the MFP is a master facilities plan, so it is factoring only facilities, but at some point, these other data points and some of these intangibles need to be considered as well, and possibly, you know, ranked higher than just looking at a facilities report.
We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute. We're talking about plans to close a number of public schools in Duval County, and we will see you in just a couple minutes.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
On the next Florida Roundup, finding Florida teachers. School districts are using tax money hoping to attract new teachers, especially in elementary schools, special education, and science, technology, engineering, and math. If you're a teacher or used to be a teacher, what have your experiences in the classroom been like? Parents and students, tell us about your classroom experiences. Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday at noon.
Mexico's picking a new president in just a few days, and it's going to be an historic election for the country no matter what, because no matter what, the next president of Mexico will be a woman. But the big question is whether Mexico's first woman president can finally do something to quell the drug cartel violence that's plaguing her country. Big answers on the next Today Explained.
Tonight at 6:30 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Life as a child of immigrants is unique, and it can present specific mental health challenges. The creator of Brown Girl Therapy has been researching that experience through her own lens and through a community she's built online. What can all of us take away from her new book, But What Will People Say? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, we are talking with three community members who are working to keep public schools open in Duval County. I want to start with a question because I know you have a related thought about that. Katie, this is Brian from formerly Twitter. He says the commissioner of education said yesterday that school closings are part of the plan. And we just hired a superintendent that listed him, that's Manny Diaz, as a reference. So talk about the plan. What is he, when Manny Diaz says that this is part of the plan, what does he mean?
Well, I think he means with the expansion of school choice through vouchers and charter schools. And so this is a decades-long issue here in Florida, as we've seen a divestment from public education, in public education, by our state legislature through the expansion of vouchers for over the past two decades, and then the expansion of charter schools. So what he is saying, he said it at the State Board of Education yesterday, this is the way it's supposed to work when he was talking about the expansion of choice and addressing school closures across the state. And this is happening in other districts. This is just not just Duval County where we're talking about school closures.
We also had a question I think it's important to address. Somebody had asked about, you know, if you don't have students in the school, why are you involved in this issue? Why does it matter? Do you want to tackle that, Tiffany?
Sure. That's a great question. And to make it really simple, if you look at that original bowl plan, on the front of it, it says, our school, our community, our future. So if you do not have children in this district and you live in the city of Jacksonville, you are already a part of this conversation. If you own a home in this district, if you pay taxes in this city, you are a part of the public education conversation. If you are grocery shopping, if you are a business owner, and regardless of having kids that sit in a seat, you drive a car, you catch the bus. So in short, if you live in this city and you are a part of our community, you are a part of this ecosystem we call education.
I want to talk about elections because there are a number of issues, including four school board races that are coming up. What are we expecting to see this political season, Kimberly, that you guys are trying to put some attention towards?
Sure. I think one of the most important things that we are hoping to do is just have people pay attention to how important the school board elections are as far as shaping the future of our community. And there are four seats up for election. The election will be August 20th. And we are encouraging the community to pay attention. I think historically we've had turnout of 20% and less, which just shows how few people are actually paying attention to public education. And as Tiffany just said, it affects all of us and every member of our community.
And Katie, are you going to be doing any direct initiatives to get people more involved or to be kind of beating the bushes so that people are starting to look at these races?
Absolutely. We are encouraging people to be public education voters, vote on this issue. And even if your district is not on the ballot, every seat on that board votes and impacts every child across the district. And every child deserves access to high quality public schools.
We know, though, that, you know, there's a lot of difficult jargon sometimes to penetrate during an election cycle. What should people be looking to hear or not hear from those candidates that's going to tell them what matters to them?
I think that we need to elect strong public education advocates, those who want to invest in our traditional public schools.
Tiffany.
Yeah. I think that when you're listening to a candidate, one of the things you don't want someone who is demonizing parents for choosing that. Parents have the choice to choose the option. And those of us and those in the community that choose public education, they have the right to do so. So anyone that demonizes or makes the community feel bad for choosing Duval County Public Schools, listen for that. That's not a empathetic person, a compassionate person, and they're not looking at this community as a whole. That's very one-sided.
We're talking about school board members being elected in August, but there's also in November, Kimberly, another matter that's coming before voters, which would make school board elections partisan.
Mm-hmm.
What is your feeling about how politics are figuring into this whole conversation?
I mean, I think it's unfortunate because I think often the politics will distract from us voting on what is in our best interest for our children. And I think that's the issue that needs to stay front and center. And party politics and national politics will just distract from the ability to focus on voting in the best interest of the children in Duval County.
So there are a number of community events coming up where people can participate. What's coming up next? Where would you send people if they're trying to get some more information and to be participants in this discussion?
Well, there are six more community meetings. There are six more community meetings. The next one is going to be, and you guys correct me, June 10th at 5:30 p.m. is the reception. It's going to be at the main school board building. And so that would be the first start for the community to actually attend. Go to the Team Duval website and make sure that you come out to all six of those meetings.
Well, I'd like to thank you all so much for being here. Katie Hathaway, Tiffany Clark, Kimberly Wolfson, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our program. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire program archive on your favorite podcast platform. You can join us Friday when our media roundtable talks about everything from the run-up to the stadium decision to the state's rollback of green energy. Just a reminder, if you are having any issues with your mental health, we did mention suicide earlier. There is a number that you can call, 988, if you need some help. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.